So if I told you that a factory strike would disrupt a firm's employment levels for, say, a year and a half, you'd probably plan your labor policies one specific way.
Right, you'd treat it as a temporary blip.
Exactly. But what if I told you the underlying math generating that estimate was actually lying to you, and that the true impact of that shock would actually linger for nearly a decade?
It changes everything. I mean, it completely rewrites how you understand the firm's rigidity.
It really does. So today we're doing a deep dive into a comprehensive study guide on estimating dynamic panel data models in Python. Specifically, we're going to show you how invisible mathematical biases can completely warp our perception of economic reality.
Yeah, and this is a huge methodological trap waiting for literally any graduate student or researcher analyzing longitudinal data. Because when we look at processes that compound over time, where this year's outcome is heavily, heavily dependent on last year's outcome, the standard estimators you learn in your first year econometrics sequence just fundamentally break down.
And the scariest part, I think, is that they break silently. Like, your Python console is going to print out this perfectly formatted table. You'll see highly significant p-values, and you'll think you have a great result.
But mathematically, it's completely indefensible.
Right. So, to map out exactly how to bypass those flawed models and find the single defensible result, we are going to walk you through the complete generalized method of moments, or GMM, workflow.
Think of this as your technical study guide.
Yeah, and we are grounding this entire discussion in the absolute classic data set for this specific field. I'm talking about Ariano and Bond's 1991 panel of 140 UK manufacturing firms.
Right, observed between 1976 and 1984.
Exactly, and the geometry of that specific data set is so important, right? It kind of dictates everything we're about to do.
It does. It's what we in econometrics call a short and wide panel. So you have a relatively large cross-section, meaning big N, where N is 140 firms, but the time dimension, T, is extremely short.
Because we only observe these firms for what, 7 to 9 years?
Yeah, exactly. 7 to 9 periods. And as we'll see, the asymptotic properties in panel data behave very, very differently when N goes to infinity, but T remains fixed.
Right.
That specific large N, small t environment is exactly where these biases bite the hardest.
Okay, so let's unpack the central methodological question we're answering with this data. We're trying to figure out how persistent is firm employment?
Yes. We're trying to isolate a single parameter called rho.
The autoregressive coefficient.
Exactly. It sits right on the lag-dependent variable, and it basically measures what fraction of last year's employment level is directly inherited by this year's employment level.
Because, if you have high capital rigidities or maybe strict union contracts, that employment level is going to be super persistent.
Right. But the mathematical friction comes in because rho doesn't just exist in a vacuum. The labor demand equation also has this unobserved firm fixed effect, which we denote as alpha.
Alpha I, right. And that represents the permanent time invariant characteristics of the firm.
Exactly. Think of things like baseline management quality, or the firm's specific industry niche, or even just the physical footprint of its manufacturing plant. It doesn't change over time.
I find it really helpful to visualize these two parameters distinctly. So rho is like the dynamic echo strength of a shock inside a canyon.
That's a good way to put it.
Right. If a firm hires 50 extra workers today, rho determines how many of those specific jobs still exist, say, 3 years from now.
Right, it's the decay of the shock.
But conversely, alpha dictates the permanent size of the firm itself. It's like planets orbiting at different permanent distances from the sun.
Yes, and the core econometric challenge here is untangling that temporary echo from the permanent orbit.
And that untangling is notoriously difficult, isn't it? Because last year's employment inherently depends on the firm's permanent size.
It does. It absolutely does. This means your lagged dependent variable is mathematically correlated with that unobserved fixed effect, alpha I, which is sitting inside the error term.
Which is a textbook violation of strict exogeneity.
Exactly. It breaks the core assumption of OLS.
Okay, so let's trace how that endogeneity breaks our standard tools, starting right at step one of the workflow. The first thing you do is run pooled ordinary least squares using a tool like PyFixist in Python.
Right. And doing that on this data set yields a rarismid of 0.962.
0.962,
Right.
which we know is biased.
Heavily biased upward. Pooled OLS just ignores alpha entirely. By omitting that firm sixth effect, the estimator basically lumps all those permanent differences into the composite error term.
Oh, so it mistakes permanent firm size for dynamic persistence.
Exactly. It looks at a firm that retains a large workforce year after year, attributes that entire effect to the lag, and just severely biases the row estimate upward, pushing it toward one.
Okay, so knowing that pooled OLS ignores the fixed effect, the intuitive next step, which brings us to step two, is to manually remove alpha I, right?
Right. We move to a fixed effects model, also known as the within estimator.
And this transformation just subtracts each firm's time series average from its own observations.
Yes. And when we apply that to our data set, the ROE estimate drops dramatically, all the way down to 0.626.
0.626. But that introduces an entirely new, deeply rooted problem, right? Nickel bias.
Yeah, nickel bias is a nightmare here. While the within transformation does successfully eliminate alpha I, it fatally contaminates the error term in the process.
Let's actually look at the underlying math of that contamination, because it is brilliant, but like totally destructive.
It really is.
Because to demean the data, you subtract the firm's average over the entire observation window, T, but that average includes future observations.
Right. You are mechanically subtracting an average that contains tomorrow's structural shock from today's equation.
So that mechanical subtraction induces a negative correlation between the demeaned lag-dependent variable and the demeaned error term.
Exactly. Because today's lag is being compared against a firm mean that contains tomorrow's shock, endogeneity is basically reintroduced through the back door.
And crucially, the magnitude of nickel bias is proportional to 1 over T.
Yes, 1 over T.
Which means if we observed these UK manufacturing firms for, like, 50 years, dividing the bias by 50 would render it pretty negligible.
Right. It would fade out.
Yeah.
But our T is roughly 7. Dividing by 7 means the negative bias is massive.
And adding more firms to the data set, like increasing N to of 1,000 or 10,000, does absolutely nothing to cure a bias driven by a short T.
Nothing at all. It just gives you a more precise estimate of a biased number.
Okay, so that leads to a fundamental question about our workflow. If you are a grad student sitting at your computer, and you know mathematically that both pooled OLS and fixed effects are fundamentally broken for dynamic panels, why do we mandate running them as the very first steps?
It's a great question. It's because they form a diagnostic boundary.
The bias bracket.
Exactly. Stephen Bond established this conceptual framework back in 2002. It's the bias bracket. We possess two flawed models, sure,
yeah.
But we know the precise direction of their flaws.
Right. OLS suffers from an upward omitted variable bias, landing at 0.962.
And fixed effects suffers from the downward nickel bias, landing at 0.626.
So the true unobservable row parameter has to lie somewhere within that interval, between 0.626 and 0.962.
It has to. That bracket is the ultimate diagnostic yardstick for any subsequent estimator you try to run.
So if a computationally complex instrumental variable approach gives you an estimate outside those bounds,
you immediately know the model is misspecified. You throw it out.
Okay, so with the bounds of truth established, we can transition to estimators that are actually designed to solve this specific endogeneity.
Right, by utilizing instrumental variables.
And the earliest historical attempt at this is the Anderson-Sau estimator. Instead of the within transformation, it relies on first differencing. You just subtract last year's equation from this year's equation.
And first differencing successfully purges the permanent foam effect, because alpha I minus alpha I is just zero.
Right.
However, differencing the error term creates a moving average process. The difference lag, delta yt minus 1, is now mathematically correlated with the difference error, delta epsilon t.
Because both of them contain the level term from time t minus 1. So to resolve that, Anderson and Sau introduced an instrument. They proposed using a deeper lag of the level of employment specifically, employment at time t minus 2, to instrument for the difference lag.
And that relies entirely on this huge assumption of sequential exogeneity.
Let's define that. Sequential exogeneity requires that past values of your variables are uncorrelated with current and future idiosyncratic shocks.
Right.
I like the analogy from the study guide. Think of sequential exogeneity as relying on witnesses who left the building before the crime occurred.
That's perfect, because the observation at T minus 2 occurred before the shock at time T or T minus 1. It cannot possibly be influenced by the current differenced error.
Right. Its testimony about the past is mathematically valid. But when we actually run the Anderson-Sau estimator on our Python data, we get a row of 1.233.
Which is way outside the bracket.
Yeah. And furthermore, it carries this massive standard error of 0.478.
Yeah, an estimate of 1.233 sits far outside our bias bracket.
Thick enemy.
It implies an explosive process where an employment shock amplifies infinitely over time.
which obviously contradicts basic economic reality. Firms don't just infinitely explode from one strike.
Exactly. And while Anderson Tsao is technically consistent as N approaches infinity, it is highly, highly inefficient. It discards an enormous amount of information by relying on a single instrument, a single witness, in your analogy, to extract variation from a really complex data set.
Okay, so we need to incorporate more information, which brings the workflow to Arellano-Bond Difference GMM, typically implemented via the PyDemDid package in Python.
Right, the classic Difference GMM.
And this operates on the insight that if T-2 is a valid instrument, then T-3, T-4, and T-5 must also be valid under sequential exogeneity.
Yes. It expands the instrument set to include literally all available lagged levels.
And then the generalized method of moments framework takes over. It constructs a system of moment conditions, essentially minimizing the distance between the sample moments and zero, and it weights these multiple instruments by their variance covariance matrix to maximize efficiency.
It's brilliant math.
It is. So we deploy Difference GMM in Python, and the software returns a row of 0.679. The standard errors look tight. The default diagnostic p-values print out as totally acceptable.
Yeah, and if you were a grad student rushing to publish, you might just accept this and write it up.
But if we evaluate 0.679 against our bias bracket, we see a severe problem.
A huge problem. The lower bound of our bracket, the heavily biased fixed effects result, was 0.626.
Right.
An estimate of 0.679 is just hugging that lower bound. It's sitting entirely in the bottom tenth of the acceptable interval.
Yeah.
And in the econometrics literature, hugging the within estimator bound is the textbook symptom of weak instruments.
But wait, we need to explain why those instruments are weak, considering we just supplied the model with dozens of lags.
Right, we gave it all these witnesses.
Yeah, it stems from the underlying nature of the employment data itself, doesn't it? Firm employment is highly persistent. When rho is close to one, the series behaves very similarly to a random walk.
And here is the fatal flaw. If a series is highly persistent, its past levels contain almost no predictive information about its future differences.
Oh, because the variance of the true signal just gets completely drowned out.
Exactly. Yeah. You have 40 valid witnesses, sure, but because they are trying to predict the unpredictable first differences of basically a random walk, their collective testimony is utterly useless.
That makes total sense.
And when instruments are weak, finite sample bias pulls the Difference GMM estimate straight down toward the biased fixed effects estimator.
So the software provided a passing grade, but the estimator basically failed completely to extract the true parameter.
Yes.
So if lagged levels are demonstrably weak instruments for predicting current differences, we have to flip the econometric script.
And that realization is exactly what led Richard Blundell and Stephen Bond to develop System GMM.
Right, the big upgrade.
They asked the inverse question. They said, okay, if levels cannot predict differences, do lagged differences contain predictive power for current levels?
And for persistent series, the answer is a resounding yes. A firm's recent change in employment strongly predicts its current overall size.
Exactly. So System GMM achieves this by stacking the equations. It retains the first difference equation instrumented by levels, but it appends the original levels equation, which it then instruments using lagged differences.
But, and this is a big but, introducing that levels equation requires a critical, completely untestable assumption: mean stationarity.
Yes. Mean stationarity.
Let's define this carefully for anyone setting up their own model. Mean stationarity allows firms to operate at wildly different baseline scales, those different permanent orbits we talked about earlier.
Right. Some firms are huge, some are tiny.
But it mandates that any initial deviations from those steady states must be systematically unrelated to the unobserved fixed effects themselves. So the firm's distance from its own baseline cannot be correlated with its permanent size.
It is a very strong assumption about the initial conditions of the data generating process.
But if it holds.
If it holds, System GMM extracts massive efficiency gains.
I try to picture this dynamically. Like, Difference GMM was basically trying to map the depth of a lake purely by observing the momentary ripples on the surface.
Right.
And when the lake is calm, like when the data is highly persistent, those ripples reveal almost nothing. But System GMM succeeds because it supplements the surface ripples by analyzing the permanent waterline marks etched into the shore. It utilizes that level information.
I love that analogy. And the empirical payoff in our Python workflow is immediate. When we run Blundell Bond System GMM, it produces the definitive defensible estimate, a row of 0.927, accompanied by a tight standard error of 0.079.
0.927, which lands safely in the upper quartile of our bias bracket.
It perfectly clears the diagnostic yardstick.
Substantively, this metric tells us that roughly 93% of an idiosyncratic employment shock survives into the subsequent year.
Yes.
And if you extrapolate that decay rate outward after 5 years, nearly 68% of the original shock remains present in the firm's labor force.
Which translates to an implied half-life of 9 years. The echo in the canyon rings for nearly a decade before dissipating. The economic rigidity of these manufacturing firms is profound.
But deriving that defensible estimate is really only half the battle. You have to bulletproof it against peer review by correctly interpreting the post-estimation diagnostics.
Oh, absolutely.
And the study guide really emphasizes that the p-values at the bottom of your standard Python or Stata output are dangerously misinterpreted by researchers all the time.
Yeah, there are three mandatory diagnostic tests you have to decode. The first one is the Arellano-Bond test for AR1 in first differences. This test for first-order serial correlation in the difference residuals.
And we can deduce exactly why the source material states this test must reject the null hypothesis. Let's just look at the mathematical construction really quick.
Let's do it.
The difference error at time tat is delta epsilon t, which just equals epsilon t minus epsilon t minus 1.
Right.
And the difference error at time t minus 1 is delta epsilon t minus 1, which equals epsilon t minus 1 minus epsilon t minus 2.
And you see it right there. Both of these adjacent equations contain the exact same term, epsilon t minus 1.
They share that overlapping term, but with opposite signs.
Right. Therefore, their mathematical covariance is equal to the negative variance of epsilon t minus 1.
And because a variance must inherently be positive, the covariance has to be strictly negative and non-zero.
Exactly. This forces a mechanical correlation.
So when your Python output returns an AR1 p-value of 0.000, you shouldn't panic and think your model is broken.
Not at all. Rejection is mathematically guaranteed if your differencing operation actually worked correctly. It is basically proof of life for the model.
Okay, but the critical hurdle is actually the AR2 test in differences. This test must not reject.
That's correct.
Our system GMM implementation achieved an AR2 p-value of 0.994, which indicates a decisive failure to reject the null of no second-order serial correlation.
And that distinction is just paramount, because if the AR2 test were to reject, it would signal that the underlying undifferenced structural errors, the raw epsilon theas, are themselves serially correlated.
And if the structural errors are correlated across time, our entire foundational assumption of sequential exogeneity just collapses.
Yeah, the witnesses at time t minus 2 would be contaminated by the ongoing shock, which would make them completely invalid instruments. So a high AR2 p-value validates our right to even use those t minus 2 lags.
Which naturally progresses to the third diagnostic, the Hansen-J test for over-identifying restrictions.
It's a big one.
Yeah, the Hansen test evaluates the joint validity of the entire instrument matrix. It's asking if all the moment conditions are telling a statistically consistent story.
Right.
But this brings up a fascinating mathematical paradox. In most hypothesis testing, failing to reject the null is exactly what we want when validating our instruments. A higher p-value suggests the instruments are valid.
Yes, that's the standard logic.
So logically, a researcher might assume a Hansen p-value of 1.0 is the ultimate sign of a flawless model, like perfect score, right?
Right.
Yet the source material explicitly warns that a p-value approaching 1.0 is a massive, massive red flag.
It is. That red flag signals a phenomenon known as instrument proliferation.
Let's unpack that.
So the GMM framework basically operates on the instruction to use every available lag. But if you consider the matrix algebra, for every single time period we move forward, a new lag becomes available.
Right.
So the number of columns in your instrument matrix Z grows quadratically with T.
And in the study guide's grid experiment, they deliberately let the instrument matrix explode just to show this, pushing the instrument count to 113.
And think about what that means. When you deploy 113 instruments to analyze only 140 firm groups, you severely overfit the endogenous variables in the instrumented stages.
You're just fitting the idiosyncratic noise rather than the underlying signal.
Exactly. And this overfitting artificially inflates the Hansen p-value. It completely strips the J-test of its asymptotic power to detect invalidity, which causes the p-value to just drift mechanically straight toward 1.0.
The analogy I use here is that the 113 instruments act like an overwhelming wave of redundant witnesses, all repeating the exact same hearsay.
That's spot on.
The judicial mechanism, which is the Hansen test, loses its ability to distinguish truth from fiction, so it just defaults to accepting everything. A p-value of 1.0 doesn't validate your model. It literally confirms your diagnostic test is broken.
Yep. So the methodological solution, which is easily implemented in Python, is using the collapse option.
The collapse option.
Right. Instead of generating this sparse block diagonal instrument matrix where every single combination of time period and lag depth gets its own column, collapsing just squashes the matrix.
It transforms the geometry. You basically combine the lags so that there is only one column per lag depth uniformly applied across all time periods.
Yes.
So lag 2 becomes a single mathematical instrument rather than having a separate instrument for 1978, another one for 1979, and so on.
Exactly. And applying the collapse command to our Erwinnabon data shrinks the instrument count drastically, taking it from 113 all the way down to 32.
Which is great because it keeps the instrument count safely below the number of cross-sectional groups. That adheres to the standard rule of thumb for panel analysis.
It does, but, you know, it's worth noting that collapsing the instrument matrix extracts a toll.
Yeah. Our uncollapsed, overfitted model displayed this tiny standard error of 0.027, but the properly collapsed system GMM model returned a standard error of 0.079.
But as the documentation emphasizes, that increased standard error is just the necessary price of honesty.
Right.
The hyper-precise standard error from before was basically a phantom metric generated by fitting the noise. The collapse model provides the mathematically defensible variance.
Okay, so to synthesize this whole methodological journey for your own research workflow, never run GMM blindly.
Never.
Always, always define your reality check by estimating the OLS and fixed effects bias bracket first. Be deeply suspicious of difference GMM estimates that fall toward the lower bound, recognizing the mechanics of weak instruments.
Right.
Deploy system GMM with collapsed instruments for persistent data series and fundamentally understand the mathematical operations driving your AR and Hansen p-values before you ever publish them.
And, you know, the imperative here really extends way beyond just writing clean Python code. The macro-level consequences of these micro-level econometric choices are massive.
They really are. Like, if a regional policymaker relies on the naive fixed effects half-life of 1.5 years to model a labor subsidy, they're going to model a temporary, rapidly decaying intervention.
But the rigorous system GMM half-life of 9 years proves that the exact same intervention will permanently alter the trajectory of the labor market for an entire decade.
The mathematical estimator literally dictates the policy reality.
Which just highlights how crucial it is to isolate the true row parameter accurately.
It does. And actually, that leaves me with the final conceptual challenge for you all, based on the limitations of this very framework we just walked through.
Oh, this is a good point.
Because Blundell-Bahn system GMM is mathematically elegant, sure, but it imposes one single common persistence parameter across the entire panel. It mathematically asserts that rho is strictly 0.927 for all 140 manufacturing firms.
It forces strict parameter homogeneity.
Right. But what if that mathematical assumption masks the actual microeconomic truth? Like, what if persistence is fundamentally heterogeneous?
Which is highly likely in reality.
Exactly. A massive multinational conglomerate with immense capital buffers and complex union negotiations is going to absorb a labor demand shock entirely differently than, say, a small niche textile manufacturer.
The underlying data-generated processes governing those two entities could be vastly, vastly different.
So what if our highly defensible 0.927 is merely a mathematically clean composite, like just a perfect average of two entirely separate economic realities that ends up describing neither firm accurately?
And that question right there is precisely the frontier of modern econometrics. Mastering the GMM workflow allows you to rigorously estimate the average effect. But the next methodological hurdle is determining whether that average represents a universal law or if it's merely a statistical illusion.
Something really critical to evaluate as you structure your own panel data, because extracting the mathematically valid estimate isn't the end of the analysis. In dynamic panels, proving the average is really just the beginning.